Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am going to cover in this audio 2 Samuel chapter 4, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 12. We're going to call this chapter Ishbosheth is Murdered. Our context is this. In the last chapter, 2 Samuel 3, Ishbosheth's general Abner, the general of Israel, all the tribes of Israel except for Judah, David, of course, is head of Judah, ruling down in Hebron. Abner decides he's had it with Ishbosheth because Ishbosheth accused him of shacking up with one of Ishbosheth's concubines. And so Abner comes down to make a peace deal with David. Everything is hunky-dory. Joab is not present there. He's out on a raid. He comes back. That's David's commander. Joab says, "What? You made a deal with Abner?" Then David basically ambushes and assassinates Abner through guile. David has got to go through a big public lamentation to show the people of Israel, the northern 11 tribes, that, hey, I didn't mean it. I didn't mean to kill him. My general did it, not me. So that was the last chapter. Abner is now gone. So all that's left is Ishbosheth up in Mahanaim. Abner had moved the capital from Gibeah on the west side of the Jordan in Benjamin to Mahanaim on the east side, right on the Jabbok River there. This is where Jacob wrestled years ago, 300-400 years before he wrestled with the angel of the Lord, with Jesus. Ishbosheth was put there to keep him safer from the Philistines, further away from the Philistines. So he's there with no general, and now he's about to meet his end. So we start now at 2 Samuel 4, verses 1 through 3. Now when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage, and all Israel was disturbed. Saul's son had two men who were commanders of bands. The name of the one was Baanah, and the name of the other Rechab, sons of Rimmon the Beerothite. Of the sons of Benjamin, for Beeroth is also considered part of Benjamin, and the Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been aliens there until this day. Now Ishbosheth heard that Abner had died. He was murdered. I just told you that story, the last chapter. Ishbosheth then lost courage. Well, it was bad enough that his great general was killed, and now he didn't have a general. But worse than that is his general died in Hebron, which was David's capital. Now, Ishbosheth probably didn't know that Abner had gone to Hebron. And when he found out, he probably figured out that Abner had gone to Hebron to betray Ishbosheth, which is exactly what happened. Ishbosheth knew that Abner was mad at him because Ishbosheth had called him out on the fact that Abner had, or the alleged fact that Abner had stolen Ishbosheth's concubine. So Ishbosheth would know that Abner's up to something down there in Hebron where he got killed. And so since Abner is now killed, Ishbosheth is now thinking, well, David is after me. He killed Abner. He's coming for me next. So yeah, he's disturbed, all right. He and all Israel was disturbed. As John Gill says, the leading men of Israel knew about Abner's plans to unite with David, because Abner had gone around politicking with everybody. Now, I just said that Ishbosheth had probably not known that Abner had gone to Hebron, but I don't know why I question that as soon as I say it, because in the previous chapter, or maybe the previous two chapters, I forgot where, but Abner had gone around to all the leading men of Israel and to the leading men of Judah to politic for this peace agreement with David and Judah. Well, if Abner is doing all that with all the leaders of Israel, it would be hard for me to believe that somehow the word didn't get back to Ishbosheth. It is possible, but I don't know. But at any rate, the elders have been convinced to make peace, but now, are they going to make peace since David's man, Joab, has just killed their chief general? It looks like now David does not want peace after all. Joab had not been condemned and executed for the murder of Joab. Maybe David's really angry with us now. So there was a lot of political confusion. But on the other hand, the elders of Israel saw or heard about David's great public lamentation for Abner. He's walking behind the casket, which is something that kings don't normally do. Wrote a nice lament, sang a lament in public. So they're confused. They're disturbed. Now in verse 2, we're introduced to two commanders of bands. These are probably bands of raiders that were raiding probably the Philistines for Ishbosheth's kingdom. The name of one of the commanders was Baanah, and the name of the other Rechab. They were sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, of the sons of Benjamin, for Beeroth is also considered part of Benjamin. Well, Beeroth and Benjamin, the place names, are carefully noted. This is to show that These people were directly involved with Ishbosheth, because Ishbosheth, of course, was from Benjamin also, as Saul, his father, was. And yet, there's going to be a murder of Ishbosheth by Benjaminites, which shows the tragic, divided state that the weakened kingdom of Israel was in, and the pitiful state of the tribe of Benjamin. Now, these two guys were from Beeroth. They ended up fleeing to Gittim, but they were originally from Beeroth. Beeroth means wells. It's one of the four cities of the Hivites which entered by fraud into a league with Joshua. You remember that story back in Joshua 8. Well, you remember the story about the fraudulent league. They made all their clothes, sandals look worn out. They'd come from a long way. And they said, hey, we're not in Canaan, so we don't get wiped out like all the Canaanites do. Some people, we don't know, people don't know where it is. Some people say it's a place called El Bira on the way to Nablus, Shechem, about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. It's somewhere in Benjamin. It's mentioned in Joshua 18:25 as belonging to Benjamin, Gibeon, Ramah, Beeroth. So this is a Benjaminite place. The people of Beeroth, this is a parenthesis, they were noted as fleeing to Gittim. The name Gittim means two wine presses. Some people say it might be Gath. Who knows? It's a town in Benjamin to which the Beerothites fled, according to Eastus, which doesn't really tell us too much. Again, the purpose of mentioning these place names is to show that the principals were Benjamites, thus illustrating the tragedy of the upcoming assassination. Now, these Beerothites had fled from Beeroth to Gittim. When did they do that? At the death of Saul, according to Gill, Benson, and Poole. This was when many of the Israelites deserted their cities and left them to the Philistines and headed for safety. We read that in 1 Samuel 31:7. When the men of Israel on the other side of the valley, that means on the northern side of the valley of Jezreel, and on the other side of the Jordan, on the eastern side of the Jordan, saw that Israel's men had run away and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. So the Philistines came and settled in them. So the speculation is the Philistines came into Beeroth and the Beerothites headed out for Gittim. Now that verse I just read you in 1 Samuel 31:7 was talking about Israelites north of the Jezreel Valley and east of the Jordan River. That doesn't apply to where we are now, down in south in Benjamin, but it could have, the same thing could have happened down there. Colin Delitch said that Gittim may or may not have been in Benjamin. Its site has never been discovered. Colin Delitch say it isn't clear if the Philistines forced the evacuation, so what I just said about that, it was a speculation that the Philistines forced them out. Colin Delitch says the reason why the Beerothites fled to Gittim and remained there as strangers until the time when this history was written is also unknown. Nehemiah 11:3 says that Gittim was in Benjamin. Nehemiah 11:33 mentions Hazar, Ramah, Gittim, that's Benjamin. The pulpit commentary denied that this was the same Gittim, saying the Beerothites are described as sojourners in Gittim, but Nehemiah 11:33 says Gittim belonged to Benjamin. How can you be a sojourner if you're going to Benjamin? You have to be outside of Benjamin. Colin Dillage says, well, maybe it was in Benjamin, maybe not. So all of that is just to say that nobody knows. It doesn't matter. I've wasted too much time on this already. John Gill just speculates that Gittim was a little further from the Philistines than was Beeroth. They went there for protection. But again, the whole purpose of that is to show that there were Benjaminites doing this. This was a civil disturbance. We go now to 2 Samuel 4, verse 4. Now Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened that in her hurry to flee, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. Now the report of Saul and Jonathan is the report that they were dead. They'd been killed in battle by the Philistines at the Battle of Mount Gilboa, which is up there at the end of the Valley of Jezreel. And Adam Clark says of Jonathan, quote, "Lovely Jonathan, unfortunate in thy life and in thy progeny." If you really look at it, it really was tragic. Jonathan was a good man, a good friend of David, but he gets killed and his son gets lamed and can't inherit the throne. That's because God is providentially working events out so that David will get the throne instead of Saul's lineage. Now, Mephibosheth was crippled in his feet. Why does the author of the text even mention that? It's a parenthetical insertion, but it had importance. It was to show the sorry state of Saul's dynasty. This shows why Rechab and Baanah are going to kill Ishbosheth, the current king of Saul's kingdom, because they knew that a lame boy could not take the throne, and thus it would be easy to deliver the kingdom to David. According to Oriental notions, lame men could not rule a kingdom, as Jameson Fawcett Brown point out. Baanah and Rechab also know that a lame boy could not be an avenger of blood. He would be the logical person to kill Bana and Rekab for their murder of Ishbosheth, but he's lame. How's he going to do it? So that's why this little detail is not incidental. It's critical. Now, Mephibosheth was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. In other words, when his daddy was killed. And we're now in our time frame now, near the time frame of the murder of Ishbosheth. We're near the end of David's 7.5-year reign at Hebron. And so that would make Mephibosheth about 12 years old, as John Gill points out. Now, how did Mephibosheth get crippled on his feet? Well, his nurse took him up and fled. It doesn't say she was fleeing from where to where. We assume that she's heading back to the royal palace at Gibeah, which is about 3 miles north of Jerusalem. And I assume also that Mephibosheth had been carried up with Jonathan at the Battle of Jezreel. Now, why in the world he would take a 5-year-old boy up to see the battle, I don't know. None of my commentators say so. They just assume that Mephibosheth was at Jezreel. Nobody speculates as to why that would be, but I'm a curious person. I wonder, but he did it, apparently. And as a result, he put the heir to the throne in trouble because he was the heir. Jonathan was the oldest son, and the way the line of descent worked was the oldest son, if he's dead, then the eldest son of the eldest son takes over. Not the brother of the eldest son, Ishbosheth, but Abner apparently figured he's not going to put Mephibosheth on the throne, even though he's the logical, rightful heir, because Mephibosheth is lame. So he puts the nearest male relative on the throne, who was Ishbosheth. John Gill points out that Ishbosheth had no right to the throne. His elder brother, Jonathan, had a son, Mephibosheth, who was still 11. Mephibosheth should have been the heir to the throne, but he was not given the throne because he was lame in his feet. Mephibosheth, by the way, also has another name, Meribaal, 1 Chronicles 8:34. The son of Jonathan was Meribaal. We turn now to 2 Samuel chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. So the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, Rekab and Baana, departed and came to the house of Ishbosheth in the heat of the day while he was taking his midday rest. They came to the middle of the house as if to get wheat, and they struck him in the belly, and Rekab and Baana, his brother, escaped. Now when they came into the house as he was lying on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and killed him and beheaded him. And they took his head and traveled by way of the Arabah all night. Then they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Behold, the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. Thus the Lord has given my lord the king vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants." So Rekab and Baana, the assassins, they departed. That's probably from Gittim where they had fled. Probably, maybe. Came to the house of Ishbosheth. That's at Mahanaim, right where the Jabbok River runs into the Arabah Valley, the Jordan Valley, going from east to west, the place where the angel of the Lord wrestled with Jacob, right near Succoth and Peniel, that area, Mizpah, where the famous Mizpah benediction was. That's where Saul had moved the capital to get the capital, Gibeah, away from the Philistines. And there was Ishbosheth, lying, taking his midday rest. Now, some say this is a token of Ishbosheth's laziness. He let Abner do all the ruling while he laid around in his house all day. Well, I don't know. In Ishbosheth's defense, everybody took a siesta in the middle of the hot day in those environs, even the most active of monarchs. So John Gill points that out. What is this business about wheat? Why would you go into the middle of the house as if to get wheat? Well, this is how the two assassins, Rekab and Baana, got past the guards. They say, look, we need to pay the soldiers. Remember, Rekab and Baana are the heads of two military bands. We need to pay our soldiers. Soldiers were paid in grain, and grain was kept in the king's granaries, and the king's granaries were in the house, as John Gill points out. So that's how they got in. They cut off Ishbosheth's head, took his head, and traveled by way of the Arabah all night. That was a hasty flight. Maybe they were scared that somebody would come and kill them and execute them for what they had done, for the regicide that they had just committed. But anyway, you go from Mahanaim, which means double camp, by the way, from Mahanaim, go west until you get to the Jordan Valley, which is the Arabah, and then you go down the Arabah Valley, and I don't know where they cut over, but sooner or later, well, they had to cut over before they got to the Dead Sea, but then somewhere they cut over to the west and traveled on down to Hebron. Now, why were they taking Ishbosheth's head to David? They wanted to curry David, favor with David. They figured, well, the kingdom of David, Judah, and the kingdom of Saul, Benjamin, they're at odds with each other, and hey, Benjamin is kaputsky now. The king's head is gone. David's going to be happy with us, and he's going to give us a big place, favorable place in the new kingdom of Israel. Well, there was another gentleman who thought the same thing, the lying Amalekite who took Saul's crown and bracelet down to David when David was at Ziklag right after the Battle of Gilboa and said, "Hey, Saul's dead. I killed him," which was a lie. And David, this is what David said, 2 Samuel 1, verses 14 through 15. David questioned him, "How is it that you were not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David summoned one of his servants and said, "Come here and kill him." The servant struck him, and he died. I guess the lesson to learn from this is don't mess with David. Don't go talking about how you are favorably inclined toward David by killing off Saul's people. Don't do that, because David's going to be really ticked off, and he's going to kill you. We go now to 2 Samuel 4, verses 9 through 12. David answered Rechab and Baanah his brother, sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, when one told me, saying, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news." Now that's the story of the lying Amalekite that I just read to you. David recalls that story and tells it to Rechab and Baanah. Verse 11, 2 Samuel 4. "How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth?" Then David commanded the young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. Now, David, you can tell he's ticked off because he takes an oath. "As the Lord lives," he said that a million times through this story, 1 and 2 Samuel, "as the Lord lives, as Yahweh lives." And then he says, "Who has redeemed my life from all distress?" The implication here is that he didn't need the help of evil people like Rechab and Baanah to redeem David's life. He didn't need that. And here you are trying to do God's work for me. You're trying to protect me by regicide. Verse 11, he says, "How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed?" In other words, how much more than when the Amalekite did it and I punished the Amalekite, how much more am I going to punish you? Now, if you compare those two stories, the Amalekite, his story was that Saul was dying. He had been wounded in battle, and he was just finishing Saul off at Saul's request. Well, as bad as that is, that's not nearly as bad as killing a king who's sleeping in his bed. I mean, it even sounds bad. It's like shooting a man in the Old West, shooting him in his back. Murdered Ishbosheth in his sleep in cold blood. Now, verse 11, David calls Ishbosheth a righteous man. How can you kill a righteous man in his own bed? Well, there's a problem. How can David call Ishbosheth righteous when Ishbosheth was a usurper of the throne over David? Someone might ask. Well, here's some options to answer that. Option number one, Ishbosheth may not have realized that David had a right to the throne, Gil suggests. I questioned that. I thought everybody by then knew of Samuel's prophecy that David would be king. So I think Ishbosheth knew that David was prophesied by Samuel to be king. So I don't think that's the reason that David calls him righteous. Second option why David calls Ishbosheth righteous is because he was the legitimate holder of the crown from Saul, and David hated regicide. I say he was legitimate. He was legitimate except for Mephibosheth, who had a lame foot. But let's put it this way. He was close to being legitimate. He was the king of Benjamin, king of Israel. And David really stuck up for the legitimacy of the house of Saul, as we've seen over and over again. He refused to kill Saul at En Gedi. He refused to kill Saul in the cave at Halakah. He did not like to see royal people in the house of Israel killed, even though they were his enemies. Well, perhaps option number three, the reason that David called Ishbosheth righteous, is because David meant that Ishbosheth was righteous in the sense of comparative innocence. Ishbosheth wasn't killing people in their sleep like Rechab and Baanah were. In other words, compared to you two guys, he's righteous. Maybe David was just exaggerating a little bit. But Ishbosheth doesn't seem to be a wicked person. He seems like he's weak, but not evil, not an evil king. At any rate, David's ticked off, and his young men execute Rechab and Baanah. Now let's look at some options as to why David wanted to, quote-unquote, destroy them from the earth. Why? Well, here's option number one. Maybe there were political motivations. By killing Ishbosheth's murderers, David makes Ishbosheth's followers appreciate David. And Ishbosheth surely had some followers. He was the king of Israel, the northern tribes of Israel. So there could be political reasons for this. Maybe David had religious motivations. This is suggested by the NIV Study Bible. God didn't want humans to take into their hands what God had sovereignly promised. And David says, yeah, God promised me the kingdom, but he doesn't want humans to try to bring it about. The NIV Study Bible says that political motivations were not David's primary motivation. I don't know how they know that. I don't know how they can read David's mind. I guess they want to make David look good. Third possible reason why David wants to destroy Baana and Rechab from the face of the earth is because he was motivated. David was motivated to do justice. Regicide is a serious crime, and no king appreciates regicide. And David was a king. You can see that all through history. You can see that in the history of the Byzantine Empire or medieval Europe. Kings don't like regicide. Here's what Clark said about the act of justice that was done by David to these two regicides, Baana and Rechab. Quote, "None ever more richly deserved death. And by this act of justice, David showed to all Israel that he was a decided enemy to the destruction of Saul's family, and that none could lift up their hands against any of them without meeting with condign punishment. In all these cases, I know not that it was possible for David to show more sincerity or a stricter regard for justice." Well, Adam Clark is usually squeamish when somebody gets killed, but he's not here. He said they got what they deserved. Now, David's men cut off the hands and feet of Baana and Rechab and hung them up. I assume the bodies were hung up too, although it doesn't say so. Hung them up by a pool there in Hebron. There's a sense of retribution here. The hands and feet were the murderer's means of killing Ishbosheth. The hands did the murdering, and the feet ran to tell David of the murder. Now, that seems a little far-fetched to me, but it's mentioned by Gill, Jameson, Foster, and Brown, and the NIV Study Bible, so maybe so. Maybe I'm not in that culture. Maybe the symbolism would have been more obvious to David's people. Now, this pool was in a public place, so the mutilated bodies were hung up in a public place. This underscored David's policy. He had tried to negotiate a treaty with Israel through Abner, although that was short-circuited by Joab's murder of Abner. Nevertheless, this act of justice right here shows that he was not going to take the throne through the murder of Ishbosheth. The mutilation emphasized that. The public hanging emphasized that. No, I'm not taking over Israel by regicide. And then, to top it all off, David took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner. Abner had gotten killed right outside of Hebron. Well, he got killed in Hebron, actually. And so he was buried there. And so the head of, well, the body of the general and the head of the king of Israel were buried in the same tomb there in Hebron, and that's the end of Israel, basically. Now, why was it just the head that was buried in the tomb of Abner at Hebron? Well, that's because Baana and Rechab had left the body of Ishbosheth back up at Mahanaim after they had killed him. They just chopped his head off and took off. So the head was all that was there. We don't know what happened to the body, I'm sure. Somebody took it and buried it somewhere. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with that sordid story. Ready to go on now to 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 through 25, and we will finally see David anointed king of Israel, all Israel, not just Judah, but Judah and all the 11 northern tribes also. So that will be in the next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.